You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us. If you've just joined us, while you're in for a treat, we have excellent guests. We always do, but especially today for the whole show, including in the next hour. But this hour, we're talking law. And then law and politics in particular, or law and society, really, because I think that's the centrality of law currently, always, but particularly recently with the kind of landmark cases we've seen handed down from the South African judiciary. And maybe you struggle to understand the legal reasoning. And that's exactly why I've invited, firstly, Professor James Grant, who's with us, Associate Professor of Law at WITS and also an advocate. James, thanks so much for being part of the show, as always. Thanks for your generosity.
Always a pleasure. Good morning to the listeners.
And here in the studio, Karen Morn, Senior Specialist Reporter at ENCA, and unambiguously the best legal journalist we have in the country. Karen, thank you much so much for coming in.
Thanks, Eusebio.
I want to start with both of you. Let's just have a lekker dynamic conversation so you can butt in while each other is speaking. The ANC Youth League, and one shouldn't take them seriously for more than 2 minutes, they've been harping on about something which more reasonable people sometimes also do say. So sometimes they accidentally mouth things that are interesting even when they don't understand it, Karen. And that is that in general, when we look at the place of law in relation to politics, James, that there is judicial overreach or judicial activism. How do you feel about that high-level critique of the judiciary in relation to South African politics?
I think it's strangely accurate, but precisely because ultimately law is about the control of power, and therefore we have the Constitution, which overarches all exercise of power, and it takes the form ultimately of the ultimate law. And so right from the outset, we are a society which has declared ourselves to a political enterprise which is ultimately controlled by law. So there's nothing surprising about that. I would also say that in a normal society, one would expect to find less guidance having to be found by the courts. But we're far from a normal society.
What I find so interesting is that, you know, I've interviewed Mokgweng Mokgweng, I've interviewed Dikgang Moseneke, I've interviewed Ray Zondo, I've interviewed Mandisa Meyer. And without a doubt, every single one of those judges has said, we don't want to do this. In an ideal society, we would not be getting involved. But we're constitutionally obligated to intervene when people are making, in institutions or state institutions, are making irrational decisions that have impact.
Absolutely.
And, you know, were it not for the judges of the Constitutional Court intervening in the ARV matter, where there was this lunacy around HIV/AIDS, how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people would have died?
But there's a technicality here. I'm surprised by your response, James, because the word overreach is a very specific word designed to give the impression to those listening when you are using it that someone is overstepping their bounds. Obviously, legal adjudication happens in all societies because legal systems is an accident of the history of states. Legal systems are set up as a way of regulating behavior between citizens, between institutions and citizens, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the basics of the legal structure. But when when politicians use phrases like judicial overreach, they are deliberately trying to tell those people who are listening, listen, the judiciary is actually going beyond the bounds of what a good jurist should do.
Oh, absolutely. They're coloring their speech. But everyone listening realizes that it's a matter of degree where the law and to the extent to which the law must intervene. The word that Karen used, I think, is absolutely apposite, which is that we saw the Constitutional Court having to intervene where lunacy was prevailing. Now, what we're seeing here is the courts intervening and having to intervene regularly because of the political lunacy. Now, that doesn't mean that our courts are overreaching by any means. It simply means that they are having to control the lunacy of our political situation.
And the problem for them, for those people who are saying, you know, this is overreach, is that pretty much in every one of these cases involving the president and a number of other matters, people have come to the court and said, oh, yeah, sure, we got it wrong, hey? Let's just, we admit, you know, completely wrong in Nkandla, completely wrong on spy tapes. Yeah, you know that, I mean, spy tapes is, I mean, the legal lessons that can be learned from that. This is not a case where the court has said these, you know, these entities or individuals and the president's legal advisors have come out and said, no, you know, this is completely wrong. On the steps of the court, every single time in the first 5 minutes, concede. But then there's this culture of, but we want to control what happens
next. The other two important things at a technical level that happens that the critics are deliberately ignoring or maybe genuinely do not understand, Karen, is of course that if we, and we'll come to the president in a second, but in relation to the provincial cases, it is really the court saying that in law, there's a contractual relationship between Karen, the ANC member who signed up for certain ANC constitutional promises, and therefore they are really just adjudicating on whether the ANC is faithful to what it said it would do when you became a member. And sometimes these critics make it seem as if the court is using some sort of external legal yardstick when it is evaluating cases in the Eastern Cape, in the Free State, and in the KZN. But it's actually simply, in effect, enforcing a contract between the ANC and its members.
It's holding the ANC to its own standards.
Absolutely.
And it's holding government and the president to the standard of the Constitution. And when that puts people in line for being put under attack, that becomes highly problematic.
Absolutely. Well, let's go for it, James, before we go into the two cases.
The one thing that just does trouble me about the criticism is probably the extent to which those making the criticism and those who hear it and find it perfectly acceptable is that I worry that people are using that language almost unconscious. They use it because they have to believe that these judges are overreaching. They are so absolutely invested. Mm. It's the normalization of corruption that we've spoken about before.
Yeah.
That they are so invested in this very abnormal society that when you have a judge step out and do the right thing, they regard it as absolutely outrageous.
Yes.
Because, of course, their normality is our abnormality.
13 minutes after 10, I'm in conversation with James Grant and Karen Moore, and we're talking about the legal, potential downfall of Zuma, and then the relationships between law, politics, and society. We'll take a break here, and on the other side of the break, we're going to have a look, firstly, at the case involving Shaun the Sheep.
Eusebius is on Twitter, at Eusebius.
James, how surprised were you in relation to the ruling when it comes to the prerogatory power of the president to appoint the head of the NPA?
Not particularly. The ruling that striking down his right to act unilaterally there, not surprised.
Yes. And you, you, Karen, what was your reaction?
I think, you know, the thing is that he hasn't taken the power out of the hands of the executive. And I think you made this point earlier this week. He's put it in the hands of the executive. He's put it in the hands of the deputy president. And the Constitution is clear, you know, and that issue of conflict, which resonated not only in the Nkosana matter, but also in this state capture matter. I mean, the president's, two paragraph appeal saying, well, even if you find me conflicted, it doesn't leave me unable. I mean,
yes.
I find that quite an extraordinary point.
I want to explore exactly that point, James, because you know what fascinated me was.
Stop laughing.
Sorry, apologies.
We are serious, yeah.
John Jeffrey made a valiant attempt a year or two back to try and drive a wedge, and I don't think it succeeded, but I thought maybe upon reflection there was something to his attempt. Different kinds of constitutional breaches that a president can have in relation to Nkandla, for example. And the point that John was trying to make as a lawyer was that, okay, not every violation is a serious violation, and there's got to be like a legal definition of serious. Sometimes maybe you can make an innocent mistake in the process of affirming, for example, I don't know, appointments, from the JSC that come before you. And clearly the architects of the Constitution must have in mind the notion of a serious breach, not just a frivolous one. Now, you know, when it comes to conflict of interest, there will be, in a trivial sense, all sorts of conflicts of interest that will arise all the time. There must surely also be a distinction between a trivial conflict of interest and a conflict of interest that merits this kind of departure from the norm.
I think that maps very nicely onto what the court in the Nkosana matter, the challenge to the appointment of the national director for that case, where it was delivered last Friday, the court drew attention to the question of blameworthiness, ultimately. Having decided that there had been all sorts of outrageous behavior, it turned to precisely the question that you're raising. How do we treat this? And it turned finally to the question of blameworthiness to say, you know what, the way we ultimately need to treat this will be informed very much by whether, for instance, this was done deliberately or whether it was done merely negligently, or I suppose, as you were alluding to now, it would be a different case entirely if it had been done accidentally. It settled, however, it first went to the fact that it looked very much like there was a deliberate attempt to flout the law. Mm. But it backed off because it said that nobody had had a chance to put facts before it. Mm. And in those circumstances only, and the president can be very glad that he hadn't put facts before the court on this. It didn't, it wasn't prepared, the court wasn't prepared to make findings. And it fell back saying, at the very least, the president had been reckless. Now, in terms of calling a president's conduct in exercising his presidential powers in this respect and on such an incredibly important matter, reckless, I think comes about as close to damning it as possible.
Yeah.
And also remember, in the Kosana matter, the court went into a great deal of detail about the president's legal authority. And the court, you know, the Nkosana matter was made possible by the president's previous strategy in regard to litigation. And it wasn't, if the Nkosana matter, if we had had, you know, this president who just done everything by the book and suddenly this issue had arisen, it would have been a different thing. But that ruling was built on all these legal corpses that have defined all the left behind by all the president's previous cases, where there was this culture of fight, defend what you ultimately concede is in the indefensible, and at the last moment say, guys, you know, got it wrong.
Yeah. Mm.
That was that case was about.
No accident, the words that Karen has just used again, the court literally used those words, that the president is now known for defending the indefensible.
On taxpayers' money, which brings us, of course, to the cost order issue.
But before I let you go, James, I mean, there's a question obviously now of what prospects are on appeal, right? Now, Karen has referred to those two lines in terms of the intention of where the argument might actually go. But I want to come back to this point, and I'm not sure whether I'm explaining myself properly. I mean, let's take, for example, the deputy president, Karen. If the deputy president has to be the one deciding who should be the head of the NPA, the point that I'm making with this trivial versus serious distinction is that if you know you serve at the behest of the president and you can be fired, for example, there's a prima facie case to be said that you yourself now have conflict of interest because you can be motivated in how you exercise this prerogatory power that has been shifted from the president to you. So, James, what does this mean upon appeal? How far will the president get in saying, yes, the head of the NPA has got to make a decision about whether I have my day in court, but I don't think that that fundamentally incapacitates me in the sense in which incapacity is, in terms of the genesis of the term in the Constitution, meant to be interpreted. I think incapacity, we think right up there with someone, for example, who may be, in terms of mental illness or otherwise, not capable of reasoning.
Yeah. I think the Constitution is fairly clear that in respect of a president who cannot exercise a particular function, then in respect of that particular function, the deputy president must step in and exercise that function. And that would be the case. It's defined, for instance, under Section 96, where irretrievably conflicted. It's all straightforward. Now, the best shot, and it's the reason why I was laughing, and I apologize for it earlier, is that The president's best shot we've seen in his notice of appeal handed in at the North Gauteng High Court yesterday is to say that this order of Judge Mlambo contemplates the existence now of two presidents in the country at one moment in time, and this is surely unconstitutional. I must say respectfully, this is the biggest load of nonsense I've heard, to the point where it has me laughing.
Yeah, absolutely. James, thanks so much for coming on. I always enjoy having you on. We did say we'd keep you for 15 to 20 minutes. Sorry, we went a little bit over time. 24 minutes after 10. Dan, I'm going to take your call. Anyone else? A couple of questions. You're listening to the experts. Do you think there's judicial overreach, or do you accept that it is regrettable but necessary in a constitutional supremacy model of democracy for the judiciary to play the role that it has been playing? And what are some of the questions you have in relation to some of these legal battles of the president and the implications for politics and society? You can make an argument or ask some questions, and let's thresh them out on the other side of this.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Karen, I want to set aside the public protector matter for the moment. I just want to stick a little bit to the last issue that James spoke about, and let's ventilate some of the prospects there. What are your thoughts in terms of the quality of the legal argument that the president will attempt to mount?
I would be surprised, but I mean, there's, you know, we can't divorce the legal issues from the political environment. And, you know, the SEA is going to have to really think long and hard about if it hears this argument. Of course, CASAC has taken this matter straight to the Constitutional Court for confirmation. And their argument is, listen, if the president wants to make this case, he must make it in the Con Court. This mustn't be something that gets dragged in through the SEA. Let's go straight to the Constitutional Court. Let's ventilate those issues there. And let's see how the court deals with those matters. But I mean, you know, the Mkolisi Mkasana affidavit was thrown out as evidence, so it wasn't before the court. But, you know, we as the public, you know, in terms of informing ourselves, must take heed of the fact that he very much explained his removal from office in terms of the president's paranoia that indeed he planned to charge him. In fact, the president said as much to him. He said, you know, my people are telling me that you are meeting with Bulalani Nguka in hotel, named the hotel in Durban, and, you know, that you're planning, you know, that you guys are meeting each other, and this kind of paranoia that he would be charged, and telling Nkasana, who was like, I don't know what you're talking about, that when I hear Nguka's name, and he said it in isiZulu, you know, I go crazy. So, you know, and it's interesting for me as well that the president has not leapt to the defense of Sean Abrams, who, of course, is now making this crucial decision. And we are hearing that there is a kind of, you know, attempt or an effort by the president to possibly not put him back in his position. But he still wants control. And there are names being bandied about for a prospective new NPA head. But, you know, the evidence in terms of what we know as the public is compelling that the president is terrified of facing those charges.
Which is exactly where that nexus between law and politics come in, and also human psychology, because even if a legal advisor, and we know that he routinely either gets bad advice or ignore it, sometimes both, were to say to him, Mr. President, there's no chance, this is the end of the legal road, he can at least buy time, which is the most that he can do.
That's been the pathology, though. I mean, you see, the difficulty for the president is that when he was fighting these corruption charges, his Stalingrad strategy of litigation began there. But he essentially, in many legal respects, built the bars for his own prison because he challenged the warrants of search and seizure on his properties and his legal representatives, and he lost. He challenged the letter of mutual legal assistance to Mauritius in regard to that so-called encrypted fax, and he lost. Sean Abrams, and I've seen the document, has informed his lawyers that all 218 of the witnesses identified as witnesses for the state have been tracked down by the Hawks and are prepared to testify. The court in the Nkasana matter, Dunstan Mlambo said, there is no obstacle standing in the way of execution. All those fights, all this over a decade, it's all coming to a head now.
Which is why the conflict of interest charge is serious.
This is why, you know, he's between a rock and a hard place. There's no wriggle room here. They're going to mount an attack based on the KPMG report issue, but any astute prosecutor, and I think Billy Downer will make this argument, will say, raise that argument in court.
Absolutely.
Eusebius Mackayser on 702 and Cape Talk.
28 minutes before 11, we're still with Karen Mornier in the studio with me, who's a senior specialist reporter at ENCA. And we're talking law and politics and some of these big legal cases that Zuma has lost. What are the implications, the prospects in law of appeals succeeding, and what are the wider implications for society and politics? Dan in Hyde Park, thank you for your patience.
How are you, Seabas? You see, my take on this is really on the reporting of all these legal processes. That's what really concerns me. Any finding against Zuma get wholeheartedly supported. There's no critical analysis of what are the judges really saying. Simply because it's against Zuma, everybody goes against that and everybody supports the judges.
Why do you say that?
I'll give you one example. One of the grounds that Zuma had raised, which Judge Lambert referred to, was that the president said that because Constitution has got a right to appoint the judge, if you say he can't because he's conflicted, you are impinging on the integrity of the judge that he's going to appoint. And so that's what Judge Lambert said. It was one of the reasons Zuma raised. And in his judgment, Judge Mulambo referred to the Constitutional Court judgment that said that the judges that chair these commissions are institutionally and financially independent because most of them are retired, which therefore means that they cannot be influenced. But he never, ever dealt with that particular ground specifically. He dealt with all the other grounds. He never, ever dealt with that one particular specifically. Because to say that you're facing charges based on the state capture report, you cannot appoint a judge. You are simply saying that if you appoint a judge, that judge is going to rule in your favor, which means the judge is not going to be independent. Now, if that is true, the difficulty I have is that Judge Mulambo was the judge of the Supreme Court of Appeal. He was appointed the judge president by Zuma, but the judges ruled against him. Mokweng, everybody was against that, saying that Zuma wants to appoint the Chief Justice so he can control him. But Mokweng has ruled against him. What will happen if Zuma faces all those 700 charges and he comes across a judge that he has appointed? Does that mean, therefore, that the judge must recuse himself because Zuma is conflicted? Also, on the state capture report, the Constitutional Court have said that, on the Commission of Inquiry, the report goes back to the president, and the Constitutional Court have said the president is not bound by the recommendation of the Commission of Inquiry. So does that mean if they come back to Zuma, he can simply reject them? My worry is we're not critically looking at what is the judge saying. If you go back,
hold on. The two things we need to separate. Let's get the boring bit out of the way first, and then we'll get into the more interesting intricacies of the legal reasoning. I, certainly speaking for myself, and I will be very arrogant about this, I wouldn't put people on my radio show who don't read critically. Karen Morn reads every single line in her judgment. That is why she is here. And if a judge makes a mistake, or if a judge hands down a case that goes against Zuma, but the quality of the legal reasoning is poor, then we will say so. I think the people who are most guilty of what you are saying, Dan, are the ones who support Zuma. So, for example, the ANC Youth League in eThekwini, they were reacting to the outcome of these cases. And when you listen to their presses, at no point do they actually engage what lawyers refer to as the ratio or the legal reasoning of the case. So I'm not sure whether I agree with you on that. But let's set that aside, because you're entitled to have that view of the reporting. And let's rather get into it. Dan makes a couple of interesting observations. He says, for example, listen, isn't this judge himself proof that in fact the president is capable of appointing someone?
The problem for Dan is that the president doesn't appoint judges. He does so on the advice of the Judicial Service Commission, who interviews the judges in public hearings and then makes recommendations to him. So he doesn't appoint people directly. That's unfortunately a bit of flawed logic there.
Okay. So now let's come to the public protector case. And I know this is a case that has been fascinating for you because you've probably interviewed the former public protector more than any other journalist in the country. So her role, her work is something that you can write a book on, Karen. And now we've got this incredible, incredible legal case. Remind us what the essence was of the reasoning, to Dan's point, the legal reasoning behind this case, what the outcome was, and then the nexus legal reason behind it.
At the heart of this case, at the heart of the Nkasana matter, is this issue of conflict. And remember, of course, that the court has been careful to say, and this was one of the arguments, that conflict isn't necessarily about what is provable. It's about perception. Now, remember, of course, when we had the arms deal inquiry with Judge Sariti, the way in which the president was involved in that, in appointing that judge and setting the terms of reference, which many may argue basically made it impossible for full and substantive investigation into arms deal allegations of corruption, basically thwarted that. Do we, you know, the perception was that that was a whitewash. And, you know, it's now the subject of litigation. Let's see what the court does with it. But the problem, I think, for the president, and this was something that came through very much in this judgment, and Thuli Madonsela has said this in numerous interviews, if you have a circumstance where your deputy minister of finance comes to you and says publicly, this family tried to bribe me to take the position of finance minister so I would do them favors, and you do nothing for a year, He obviously said to Parliament, I'm waiting for the outcome of this case, et cetera, et cetera. But that was, you know, before then, there was no action. There was this sort of half-hearted attempt by the ANC, which went nowhere. But I mean, it's like Thuli Madonsela said, your house is burning and you're standing there chilling in the lounge. I think that in some respects,
but can you explain to us how the issue of conflict of interest, how it appears differently in the two cases? So in the case involving the head of the NPA, it is overt. And yes. I've heard you use that word with your colleagues on ENSA, right? That it's quite overt because you must decide whether my four charges with 783 instances counts need to be heard. But here, there's
this is overt. Remember,
just do two things for me. How did the court weigh that? And then give me your take as well.
Well, Jacob Zuma was notified that he was an implicated person. And the specific issue here for him is this violation of the Executive Members Ethics Act, in which the allegations are and the evidence is, including from his own, you know, former deputy minister of finance, is that he allowed his family, the Guptas, to essentially subsume his presidential role to appoint ministers. And that there were further allegations of manipulation of SOEs. We've seen some of that further evidence emerging in the parliamentary ESCOM inquiry. But essentially that he gave up on his constitutional mandate to make clear and considered decisions about ministerial appointments in order to further the interests of this particular family and his son, who is in business with them.
Okay.
The court has said that, you know, this evidence that, you know, that under the corruption legislation, it is a criminal offense. If you are an official and you are made aware of corruption allegations, you don't do anything. That puts you in line for prosecution for corruption.
Okay, so it's apples and apples.
Apples and apples.
Sure. John in Blackgowrie, it's lovely having you on the show again.
Hi, hello, UCBS. Hello, Karen. I always have to pay compliments to you, Karen, for your crisp commentary on legal issues. A question I've been pondering, I put on Facebook, and I asked my Facebook friends, as to whether we should actually somehow press charges of contempt of court against Uzwanele Manye, the ANC Youth League, and Basipile Dlamini for their credible attack on the judiciary in claiming and saying they should be impeached and that they have a defender, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, I'm disinclined myself because freedom of expression must be paramount and let these people make a fool for them, fools of themselves. But there comes a point where in the absence of the president showing a good example of respect for the law and the rule of law, that somehow we have to probably take drastic measures there too as civil society and say, we are taking these folk on trial for contempt of court and disrespect to the judiciary. What is your thoughts on that?
Look, I think the Black Lawyers Association statement was really powerful and important. And I think that, you know, if people want to make allegations of corruption and malfeasance against the judiciary, let them. But they must produce evidence. And in the absence of evidence, I think there needs to be some kind of strong action or rebuke. Even if it isn't, you know, running to the law and saying contempt of court and et cetera, you know, I'm not sure that this is helpful. I am deeply concerned about the environment at the moment. Mm. I do feel that there's a level of exasperation that I haven't experienced before from the courts, that they just have had enough. And this reminds me very much of the Al-Bashir debacle. Remember, of course, the court giving the ruling in that matter, government seemingly contemptuous of it, allowing him to leave because of, you know, obviously the political implications of them actually,
absolutely,
you know. But in the wake of that, Gwede Mantashe saying, oh, well, we expect these kind of rulings from the North Gauteng and the Western Cape Our Court, Nati and Clare Court giving that address to IPED, saying that, you know, suggesting all kinds of that these judges are agents. And I would just urge public officials, you have every right to criticize the judiciary. Mokhoeng said it. He said, you know, many times, go for it. You know, we want to hear what's your problem with our legal reasoning. We invite that. Mm. But be specific. And if you're going to criticize having the actual judgment.
Absolutely.
Please.
The other issue that John's comments raises, of course, is the limits of legal adjudication to deal fundamentally with questions of governance and politics. There's only so much the court can do. It can rule on the legality of the exercise of public power. Whether there's compliance for and with the letter and the spirit of the ruling is then up to you and I as civil society writ large to then evaluate our public elected officials and decide what are we in turn going to do.
You know, with the Supreme Court of Appeal in the spy tapes matter, what was so interesting there was that Kimche Kemp and Hilton Epstein for the, you know, for Zuma and Hilton Epstein for the NPA were pushing the court to say, yeah, no, we totally admit this decision not to prosecute was invalid. But, you know, we want directives from the court. We want you to say, you know, must he go to court? And the court stepped back from that. It just said, look, this is invalid. We uphold that the decision of the High Court, which stated explicitly that the president should face charges. Mm. But we're not going to get ourselves into giving you those orders. And it was a very, very interesting choice. And I think it was the right one. You know, fast forward a few weeks, we now see a court giving very explicit directives in the wake of the state capture matter, very explicit directives in the wake of the costs, etc. And I think what we saw in the wake of that SEA ruling maybe proves why they did that. Because we had this extraordinary situation where you have a court saying, yes, the president should be prosecuted. And then the NPA saying, well, we now have to have a new fresh representations process that's obviously been put up for legal criticism, and this paralysis to act. And it is not healthy for any society to be relying on judges to tell you what to do.
Absolutely.
They don't want to do it. They want to say to you, this was wrong, do the right thing. But people don't seem to be taking that opportunity.
Let's talk a little bit about the prospects of appealing this judgment in relation to the recommendations of the public protector that there be a judicial commission of inquiry and that the CJ should be the one that appoints the judge. There's a really fascinating little legal issue here that the court will have to deal with. I don't think it's a fatal problem for the Concord, but imagine the case goes all the way to the Concord.
Yes.
I would imagine, and this has happened before.
Yeah.
I was trying to wreck my brain for an example when I saw you talking on Newsnight on ENCA about it. Presumably, one simple way to deal with a potential conflict of interest that might reside in the CJ is that he just takes himself out of the case.
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, I don't know necessarily that this case is going to go all the way. But I mean, again, the court will be alive to the political environment and they'll have to consider, you know, is this a case that needs, it is a constitutional point. Mm. CASAC has taken this matter to the Constitutional Court for confirmation. The Constitutional Court will have to confirm it. And I think the CJ may well make a decision, to step out of it, because if he doesn't, I mean, can you imagine, like, Tweets for days. Tweets for days.
14 minutes before 11, Bonnet. I see your call. Anyone else? We've got 14 more minutes with Karen. If you want to ask questions or have your say, maybe you disagree with us. We have some large overlapping consensus between James, myself, and Karen about the place of law in our politics. Give us a call. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567. And as we go to the break, maybe one final question I have for you as you're listening to this discussion. In general, do you think that the judiciary is simply way too ubiquitous in terms of its presence in South African politics? Sometimes people think that a lower court made a mistake if something is taken on appeal, an appeal is granted, or leave to appeal is granted, or even when something goes to the Concord, and they think, you know, we really need to put the pause button over the very strong both legal reasons and obiter dicta of the lower court. But just explain to the public how confirmation of constitutional matters work.
Well, in this state capture decision, and actually in the Nkosana matter as well, you know, the court made certain constitutional declarations, and it said that, you know, in the Nkosana matter, the powers of the president, constitutional powers of the president to appoint, suspend, remove the head of the NDPP should be given to the deputy president. And, you know, we know that that matter will be taken to the constitutional court for confirmation. So the court will hear, you know, that there's an opportunity then for the parties in this case to do the same thing as is the case in the state capture matter, because they're also taking away, you know, presidential prerogative in essence because of this issue of conflict. So those two matters, and the issue of conflict and the issue of the president's inability to perform constitutional functions, will both have to be, you know, like presided over and confirmed or rejected by the Constitutional Court. So there is going to have to be an appeal. It's not really about the president's strength of his argument. He seems to be trying to take this to the SCA.
Okay.
But I think the argument will be that this is so pressing, it's so important, given the words of the court over these issues, they need to go to Concord and they need to be decided by the Concord.
Sylvia, good morning.
Good morning. This might be coming out of left field, but is there a case to be held for accusing Zuma and Gupta's whoever with treason, and what constitutes treason?
Treason has been used in our political discourse recently in a non-legal sense to try and use the word treason's power to describe the political and material consequences of their behavior, but probably in law not, Karen.
No, I don't think so. I think it's an emotive and provocative kind of term.
And that's fine in the hurly-burly of politics.
But it's within the framework of the law, no.
Barnett in Weinberg, good morning. What is your question or comment?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, sir.
It's Barnett here. I just want to, something that the judge made, he said the Constitution is the ultimate law, is the rule, and your three arms of government, they are servants of that particular set of rules. And I find that with the term of overreach, and I think that there should be an equal maturity shown by all three arms of government. And at this current moment, the two arms don't show any form of maturity compared to the judiciary, and in exercising their functions, and they all have different functions. So, and when they execute their duties and they go wrong, and they then want to use that their error to, and use the Constitution to justify their errors, they get it wrong. And I find that is where the whole concept of overreach comes from. And until the other two arms of government become mature in executing their functions, we will always have this juncture where, or this disconnect where they assume that the judiciary is overreaching because they don't interpret the rules of the game correctly in which they are supposed to play. And that is my comment.
I disagree with James earlier, who joined us, and I love James to bits. I've got an intellectual crush on him. I think it's unambiguous. There is no judicial overreach here. I mean, this is just legal adjudication.
Yeah, you see, the thing is that the court has an obligation to uphold the Constitution, and that's what they've done. And the president can't get around the fact that he is conflicted. In the state capture matter, he's done nothing. So if you are not convicted, then demonstrate it to us on a perceptual level. Because the court is not saying, they're saying there's a clear perception here. And in both matters, if you ask the average person on the street, you know, how they deal with this. But I like his point about maturity because, you know, with the president, he's basically saying, it's my job. Like, I mean, I see the same behavior in my brother's little, you know, my little brother, my little niece and nephew. You don't take their sweetie away from them. They're going to give you hell.
We do have case law going back to the 90s.
Exactly.
Very early cases like the Hugo case, for example, including cases that implicated the exercise of prerogatory power of President Nelson Mandela when he, for example, wanted an early release for moms who are in prison. And some people were saying, no, but that's gender discrimination. And the point of it is that early on in our democracy, way before Zuma was even the president that he has become, we had established in constitutional case law that even prerogatory power that resides in Madiba is subject to judicial review.
I love that point because you remember the Safu Louis Late matter where the president faced these horrific allegations, which were actually... were not fair. And he went through a court case and the High Court, you know, ordered him to come and testify.
Yes.
And he went. He disagreed with it, but he went on SABC, said, I don't agree with the court, but I'm going to do this. And then at the same time, he launched a constitutional appeal and he was successful because there was a realization that I may find this personally affronting. I'm facing these allegations with regard to Safu and Louis Late and all this drama, but in the interest of rule of law, in the interest of being seen to be a leader who will do the right thing, I will go through this process. I will endure this bruising judgment and I will appeal it. You know, I will show deference to the legal system. That deference has, you know, arguably, unfortunately, not been shown by our current president.
Mm. So just a final reflection. We've only got a minute left, Karen. I mean, you are not a specialist political reporter. You really are
Thank
on the legal
God.
Beat.
Yes.
However, it's been amazing looking over the last few years in your career how the bulk of these legal cases have been fundamentally about our politics.
You know, the fascinating thing about President Jacob Zuma, I mean, I've covered so many cases. I can't even number. Like when he was facing the corruption charges, his rape charge, of course, he was acquitted. Subsequent to that, then these, you know, the reversal of the decision to prosecute, litigation around that, litigation around Nkandla, litigation around access to the spy tapes, the result, you know, it's just been a kind of deluge. And, you know, the president inadvertently has set the path for amazing case law. He's ensured the power of the Office of the Public Protector is constitutionally strengthened. He said, you know, we've had these judicial pronouncements about what leadership is, what it, you know. But yeah, it's not healthy, actually.
Absolutely.
It's not healthy for any
Absolutely.
Of us.
Absolutely. And for me, the sort of summary thought on that is that these inadvertent cases may be really cool for judicials, for legal theory scholars to work through. But on the Karima Brown Show, the South African Council of Churches made the point when she put it to them, you guys must feel vindicated with all your reports, having heard the latest cases come out against the president. And they said, no, actually we are not, because principles like the doctrine of conflict of interest is politically and morally so trite, we shouldn't need the court to establish those principles.
And I love that point, because ultimately you want leadership who don't end up in courtrooms because they're doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a tragic indictment of our current situation, that whether it was in Nkandla, you know, whether it was the spy tapes, whether it was this matter, we are forcing our courts to get into situations where they have to force people who should know better
100%.
To do the right thing.
Karen, you've been excellent. Thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.